It's Ken Bergen here, and welcome to the Hospo Reset podcast. Each episode, I explore trends, innovation, and smart thinking in the hospitality industry with a particular focus on restaurants, cafes, and food service. You'll find the show notes and links for today's episode on your podcast app and look for the link at the top of the hosporeset.com website. Don't forget to subscribe to the weekly Hospo Reset newsletter and connect with me on LinkedIn and on Twitter. Hi, it's Ken Bergen here from the Hospo Reset podcast, and today I'm talking to Paul Rifkin. He's a chef consultant and works with a wide variety of clubs, pubs, and food service operators. I've known Paul for quite a few years and always been a big admirer of how he really loves to look after his staff and gets, you know, great productivity from people, and I think recognises maybe more than some do that this really is a people business. Sure, we're putting food on plate and we take product and we transform it, but unless we got good people who with good skills, good enough skills, and taking responsibility, it's just not going to come together the way we want. Anyway, Paul, great to talk to you today.
Yeah, good afternoon, Ken.
Hey, Eddie. And I guess we're having this conversation with a background to continually unfolding news about COVID restrictions and staff shortages and all those sorts of things. But I think there's some kind of evergreen factors that you and others, I don't know if pioneered is the right word, but, you know, I've really put front and centre about how you recruit and manage people that I think are going to really are essential if we're going to somehow manage this sort of staff shortages successfully. Just tell us a little bit about your background as a chef, where you started, what you've been doing more recently.
Oh, well, as the chef, I started accidentally because I was actually at Sydney Uni at the time doing archaeology and Latin silly things.
Classic of things that a chef begins with,
Absolutely. And then I just found myself in the kitchen and it's sort of developed from there. And 40 years in the industry, I spent about 17 years in a club, a large one, a Campbelltown Catholic Club, and watched that grow and was part of the process.
How many staff were under your responsibility there?
So in the catering, there was up in the end, it was nearly 150 staff that sort of worked in catering across about 14 kitchens and so many venues, about 3,500 seats. Yeah, every type of food style that there was, from a convention centre, 4.5 star hotel, golf club, fitness centre, fine dining, we had it, brewery. Yeah, I don't think there was many boxes left unticked at that venue. And I sort of learned a huge amount in the development and just growing the business along with all the other people that work there.
Mm-hmm. So you seem by nature an optimist around people. I think it's a little bit hard for all of us to be optimistic about the industry in general at the minute, but I think you're like me, we're kind of glass half full people by nature. What keeps you optimistic about the people side of hospitality?
Well, hospitality, just the word itself, has been hospitable. And in a room that you walk into, there is a number of people that are hospitable and a number of people that want to take. And those that are hospitable have a need to help and do things for other people. And they derive great enjoyment from that process and everything to do with it. And so that keeps me positive and optimistic in that the act of dining is always going to be there, and there's going to be people that just derive so much enjoyment from being part of that process in the preparation and delivery of, you know, the food items, the restorative, the old French sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you seem to have a particular knack with taking young people, school leavers or school age trainees and things like that. What is it that you kind of, how do you keep them interested? Because they're the ones that most operators despair. Everyone says you should be taking apprentices and they just kind of roll their eyes and say young people these days, dot, dot, dot. But you seem to have a different approach to that.
Well, the whole industry had gone from that, and it had run like that for, you know, I don't know, hundreds of years, where people went in young. I mean, I knew executive chefs that started when they were 13 years old when they were in France. Mm-hmm. And the first 3 years was like a free paid part of their apprenticeship, and then they started the paid part of their apprenticeship. So it was hard yakka. I'm talking about people that, you know, are now in their 80s and 90s. So it's a fair while ago. But it was always to get them young enough before, I don't know, they've changed their passions into something else. And And then with that, you can mold it, meld it. And the beauty is that even if it's not for them, by the time they finish, have a qualification, have bought their first car, quite often they've put deposits on houses and things like that, the rest of their mates are only just finishing school or halfway through uni or in that sort of situation. And you can go back to that. And I certainly know some who have done that and then who've later come back to the industry even after they've sort of gone through second careers and then come back as a return career. So that's why I find it so important to sort of get that passion while it's young.
Right, so get in early. So what's your approach? Hospitality is a pretty popular subject in a lot of schools. Do you kind of approach the hospitality teachers, or how do you kind of get in at that stage at school level? What's the point of entry? What are the magic words that you say when you get on the phone to teachers? Or,
well, I mean, the work experience was the way it was done when I was an employer with staff. And you align yourself with the various training organisations that are in those various areas, whatever suburbs, whatever around the state that you are. There's school-based apprenticeships available. There's lots of things that align businesses with training organisations with schools. Mm. And it's how you build that relationship with the school, because the whole thing is to become an employer of choice.
Yeah.
And kids are very, you know, they're wise and wily. And, you know, they don't just want to go anywhere. They watch MasterChef. They want to make sure where they're doing their work experience is not just the local fish and chipper and stuff. They want to make sure that they're going to go a place where they're going to learn, and they're going to get a little badge and the kudos from it from their peers. And so it's building that relationship, and then the rest will start to flow, because the training organisations will want to be involved with you because they get great feedback from their students, and so they want to send more students. It's sort of like it's a circular thing.
Yeah, and the teachers know that you tick the boxes around safety and the right kind of experience that the students are meant to have and that sort of thing. Mm.
Yeah, because, well, in some cases they send them to places where there's no induction, there's no safety, there's bad language, there's poor performances, and the kids don't want to be there. And then they start ringing up sick, and then the employer complains to the school or the training organisation that they're a shit student. It's like, which came first?
Yeah, so someone's just got their restaurant open for maybe a year and wants to start taking on a trainee, or sees this as a way to kind of help solve labour shortages. By the way, does it solve labour shortages, or is it just a little kind of extra on the side, do you think?
Well, if you're a negative thinker, it doesn't solve anything. If you're a positive thinker like myself, then yeah, it's what is required. You know, it's fine to say there's a shortage of chefs, and I know this has been an age-old sort of conversation, but at the same time, there's been, over the last 10 or 15 years, there's been this pressure on costs, and so big hotels have stopped taking that many apprentices, have been told to take no apprentices, and they've thought that the only way that they can keep replenishing the pool was to keep bringing people in from overseas and use that as a replenishment source.
Yeah,
but it's now been shown to be very short-sighted, and those that had good setups and training things where they were sort of hashing through the apprentices, bringing them in, training them internally, working with training organisations, they're the organisations now which actually have a pool of apprentices and a pool of chefs and are not struggling anywhere near as badly as others, because they had the foresight to start developing people early.
Mm. So that kind of positive mindset around seeing the benefit of having apprenticeships, how do you handle someone who's more negative around that? If you say you've come in for a consulting job to sort out kitchen performance, and you can see this is one of the things that, you know, is missing, is that a first order thing that we need to get some trainees and apprentices, or is that going to come later?
No, because if the chef and the systems are no good, there's no point in adding more stress on by putting someone that needs training. The training needs to start at the top, and when all the ducks are in a row, then yeah, definitely, then you can sell the sizzle, sell the advantages of training, and also explain that if you're not bringing them in, you're not going to have them later on. It's the old IBM thing where you train so they'll be good for someone else, and you're hoping someone's doing the same for you.
Yeah,
That approach needs to come back.
Mm. So when it comes to recruitment, when I look at a lot of the job ads that are posted on social media forums or job boards and all those sorts of things, they seem to miss out on the things that we're talking about here, about opportunity and training and development and things like that, which will appeal to kind of younger ones, but also, you know, older ones maybe who've just want to develop this as a career. They seem to miss out on a lot of the key elements there. What are some things that you like to put into a job ad when you're, if you're responsible for them?
Well, things have changed sort of even in the last 4 years since I've sort of not been executive chef or running anything. Well, in a consulting role, I certainly end up running things still, but back then you could be a bit more demanding on what you require. But even still, people want to come and work for you because A, you're employer of choice, and B, you're providing something that they want as well, which is they have a life, they have a lifestyle, they have a family, and work is not number one, family is number one. And you have to understand that and understand in your recruiting that this is what you're going to do for them, what are they going to do for you? And so you can't just cut and paste the same advert you've been using, which is normally it's got a ridiculous number of words that the chef can't even read because of the amount that's there and the complication of them. Mm-hmm. So it really just has to be simple. You can't be employing someone to be a junior and then telling them a week later, oh, you're now the head chef.
Yeah.
And that is a very typical ploy that people have, where they'll advertise for a sous chef. What they really wanted was a head chef at Sous Chef Money, and then they explain it to them. And I certainly know of a number of chefs who never wanted to be head chef and have walked into that, and then they've left within a number of weeks because it wasn't for them. So it's advertising exactly what you want and make it clear. That's the key, I think, at the moment.
Yeah. Well, and what are you saying about benefits and salary? Obviously, salaries and pay are on the rise. Are people being more imaginative with benefits, or what are some benefits that you think people should be adding or promoting that will make their ads more attractive and the offer more attractive?
Well, the important thing is self-development. A person wants to come to an organisation that's going to back them. It's got room for growth, so there's career possibilities, mm-hmm. but they're also going to help them with their training, and not only just themselves, they're actually going to train and help the actual people that are with them, because there's nothing worse than going to a place and finding out that, you know, people have very, very low skills and the organization doesn't want to invest anything in them to develop them.
You're the only one who knows how to make most of the things.
Exactly.
On the menu.
Exactly. So I've seen many a head chef walk into a role where they get paid a ridiculous amount of money, and then they find out they're the bloody only one.
Yeah.
Everybody else is literally unable to work unassisted because no one's developed them, no one's put anything into their training, mentored them or anything like that. So there definitely has to be something there that entices someone into that situation.
Yeah. So you work with a lot of regional places, and they don't have big city excitement and big city population and all those sort of things. What are some things that you think regional operators should be promoting as well to make their offer more attractive, things that maybe they just forgot to mention?
Well, the fact that they're regional, it's now what people want. There's certainly a lot of exodus from the cities, and as that's happening, regional areas are growing. And there's also, because you've had a lot of people that are doing working from home that don't need to be working in offices. I mean, I certainly know of quite a lot that have moved into even the regional area that I'm in, and they might only go to the office once a week or once every 2 weeks. So you've got highly skilled individuals coming out into a regional area where the demand for what is provided in food, that standard is now, there's more demand for it to be a higher standard, mm-hmm. than if it had just been the original regional town. And that's going to keep growing. And so that's the first thing, is that chefs have to be enticed to know that your customer here is actually a fairly educated customer. And the fact that you've got regional produce, like, I mean, I buy meat where I am, which is killed within 20 to 30 kilometres of where I'm sitting, which is, you know, that's about as local as it gets.
And, yeah.
You know, I don't have a lot of shortages for a lot of produce because there's so many roadside markets along the road that drive around here. So, and the chefs that I know that live in the region around where I am, very excited by the fact that they can use that local produce, that they can engage with farmers. Farmers are only a short trip away, so you can take the chefs. I mean, I've done that in regional areas where I've organised with local farmers and local producers and abattoirs, and then taken the local chefs out and let them see where their produce comes from. So, and that's what excites chefs. So regional people can definitely be doing that, and yeah, look, they're already doing things like, we're going to provide the moving costs, and we're going to, sometimes they're providing full accommodation.
And I think about more the whole thing is housing and accommodation. It's as severe in country towns as it is in the city. We sort of have this rosy idea of kind of empty houses and in empty shop fronts and things in regional towns, but it's pretty difficult, isn't it?
Yeah, look, definitely. But I've also seen venues get burnt badly by engaging a chef, going out and renting a house for them, and then the chef doesn't show up, pulls out 2 days, 3 days, whatever, or a week after they arrive, and they've signed a 12-month lease on a property.
So what's the way around this? Because there's also chefs who'll say, well, my rent's going to be $600 a week there, forget about it.
In some areas it could possibly be. So, but definitely providing some sort of rent assistance to start, because it has to be a two-way street. The employer can't be taking all the risk, and the chef has to be sold the lifestyle, the regional produce, and sold all those positive things that are there.
Yeah.
And the fact that they can create food that is still going to be on par with what they were doing back in the cities.
So you're talking about the chefs, maybe it's like yourself, who really love the opportunity to be creative and sort of almost start from a blank slate and build something new and fresh. But there's a whole other bunch of people that would terrify, aren't there, who really just want to know that it's a well-organized place, everything is kind of predictable, and there's no shortages of the equipment all works, and they don't want to be creative types.
Well, yeah, absolutely. And then from that point of view, the venue should be providing an establishment that's well stocked with good equipment. There's nothing worse than sort of starting a job and walking in and finding there's a latch to hold the oven door up, and only three of the six burners work. And you know, when you're using that salamander, you've got to put it on that side at this angle. And look, these are realities.
Yeah,
I mean, I see it all the time. Don't use that slicer because that one will nick you because it's got a chip out of it.
Yeah.
These are, you know, like, who wants to work with bad equipment? Who wants to work with bad tools?
I've always thought the phrase modern kitchen is a good one to include in an ad, but we've really got to back that. It's got to be the truth. We know just pretending that it's everything's working if it's, yeah, burners don't work and that fridge over there only uses the left side, not the right side.
Yeah. Oh, look, and I see that. I see that with kitchens that I walk into where the chefs are pulling their hair out because, you know, they've got two ovens that are identical, and this one only works on dry heat, that one only works on steam. If you go over 250 degrees in this one, it'll actually, you know, the sensor cuts off. and they've all worked out systems how to make these things work. But,
yeah,
you know, if you can get everything working as it should be, And the added advantage of having things all working correctly is that you actually save labour and you save money in reality because you're not paying repairers. And in regional areas, getting repairers is not like in city where people complain when they're 3 hours late.
Yeah.
You know, in regional areas, they could be 3 weeks late by the time they get there.
So you've talked about a few other kind of more creative ways of recruiting people. I mean, it's just finding people that are available and ready for, usually for part-time work. And tell us about the mum force. Who are these people?
Well, the mum force are people that who have cooking skills already, and who need money. So their kids are at school and they're available during the day while kids are at school, and they're available in the evening when hubby gets home or when partner gets home or something like that. Mm-hmm. And they don't want to work all the time, but they want to work some of the time. And so that is a whole workforce waiting there for you. And certainly in the last place that I ran, Campbelltown, I had a lot of the mum force sort of working there. And we're providing employment, they're providing skills, and there's commitment from them because they need to work, they want to work, and they're able to do those jobs because they've been cooking for 10 or 15 mm. years for their family. So they understand.
Families are like a rather large project management training, aren't they?
absolutely. And yeah. The thing is, these people are also part of the community, and they draw customers in themselves. So
I've talked to lots of operators who really would find juggling all these kind of, I can't work here and I can't work that and this day's good for me and all that. And old-fashioned rostering, that really was a pain in the ass. But new-fashioned rostering with online systems, it actually, you set your template up and it actually doesn't need to be something that involves a million phone calls. It can be run much more automatically. You've still got to have a certain number of people at certain shifts and all the rest, but it can be much more, you know, easy to manage, I think.
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, I used to run a matrix and there was a lot of staff and some people could only work this time, that time, and other people. I had a variety that it changed every second or third week because it depended if they had the kids or didn't have the kids or whatever it is. But the thing is that if you set it up and set up all the matrix out, and as you say, it's automated now, it's very simple to sort of roster in that regard. And the reality is you're after skilled people to produce food. Mm. And it's creating the position, providing the training, and then letting them do the work. You could call them a chef, a cook, or whatever you want. It doesn't really matter. All you're trying to do is create the end result.
What about this is the mum force. I call them the pop force, which is mums and dads, 50 plus, because everyone talks about opportunities, should be more opportunities and discrimination against older people and all the rest. And I have a few different thoughts about that. But, you know, how do you make this work suitable for the 50 plus age group or attractive for them? What are they wanting?
Well, they just want to work after a few hours a week. And in that regard, I mean, I used to have people working for me that were sales reps during the day and would work one or two nights a week for me, Friday, Saturday night, and would just do 3 hours. And they were blokes. So blokes, girls, it doesn't make much difference. But there's definitely a retiree force that's out there of people that don't want as much work anymore and are quite happy just to do stuff, whether it be weekends or during the week or during the day or during the evenings or whatever. There's definitely a whole workforce. And in Australia, it's one of the, I think Australia, I read some stats, which has got the most unutilized retiree sort of workforce in the world. It's like 3%, whereas in other countries it's 30 or 5%. That's a massive gap.
What holds organisations back from, is it the way they write the ads that don't attract it, that the oldies think, oh, that wouldn't suit me? Or what is it? Why are they not applying for these jobs?
Well, I guess an establishment needs to make it clear to people and also change the way that they advertise. I mean, sometimes in a club, I tell them they should just put an A-frame board up near the front desk or something and just let them know what's available. And some clubs that have got, 10, 20, 30,000, 5,000, whatever number of members, but they've got some traffic going through and they've got people looking at those boards, and whether it's them that wants the position or whether it's their daughter or their son or their neighbour. I mean, definitely when I was in Parramatta, anytime we wanted a chef or something, we just put an A-frame out the front in Phillip Street.
Yeah.
And one of the customers would come through and say, oh, look, my son's looking for an apprenticeship.
Right, yeah.
So I think you have to be a little bit smarter the way you sort of go out and look up
I've just opened up an ad, which I took a screenshot of it because I was just so shocked by it. You could tell me what you think about it, but it was for a pastry chef, someone, and I know this place, it's a production place, and they just got to really do a huge amount of volume, and I think they're nice people, but it says we're looking for experienced, fun, vibrant, hardworking individuals to join our rock star team. Now, to me, if you're after anyone of any age, oh boy, is that saying be under 30 or whatever?
Oh, absolutely. It's saying to a 20-year-old. And yet the reality is what you want is you want a person who used to be a baker, left bakery and got an office job and now just is quite happy to go and do production because there's
yeah, not a huge maybe wants thinking. To even come in at 4 o'clock in the morning and just do a yeah. morning shift. Yeah. Get a whole lot done, talk to no one, just have the radio on and go home.
Well, that's it. I mean, I remember I used to work at Dairy Farmers overnight, and the amount of milkmen that I used to see come in that had full-time daytime jobs and then arrive at 2 a.m, start picking up, start their milk run. Yeah. And then by 6 o'clock, they were unloading all the crates in those days and then they'd be off to their plumbing job or whatever it was. Yeah. So
is there any other ways when you've been, you know, helping clubs or pubs with their recruitment that you've reached out to the over 50 workforce or any other or places you've seen are successful with that?
Well, I've basically seen that age group in nearly every place that I've gone into. A lot more in regional areas, definitely. There seems to be a lot of them. I mean, I've walked in and seen people that I'm like, what are you doing here? And I'm watching them. They're making pizza and that's all they do, you know? He says, oh, yeah, I used to be a chef in the army, you know, 45 years ago. And here he is. He's, you know, in his late 60s and he's just making pizza in a club two nights a week.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so how do you know those people are out there if you don't ask or let people know that they're after. I mean, even caravan parks. I've seen people go around asking in caravan parks, anybody looking for work? So it's there's definitely a lot more creativity required in recruitment these days than before.
So Paul, putting our productive kitchen together, let's say we're taking a much more imaginative approach to recruitment. We're making it's a really great place. It really works well. We've got good equipment, efficient recipes are written down and all those sorts of things. If you go into places and they're keen to update, what's the sort of technology and modern systems that you like to kind of get people using so that the costs are known and under control and labor's allocated correctly and those sorts of things? Well, sometimes it's called the tech stack. I don't know if you use that term, but what's some of the technology that you and digital controls that you like to implement?
Oh, look, there's definitely good controls out there with rostering, as you know yourself. Some of the good ones that I've seen out there, I won't say brands, but there's definitely some good ones out there where staff can actually swap shifts between each other, yep. and yet the technology won't let them swap a shift unless they meet that skill requirement for that particular role, and it won't let them accept the shift if they are going to be pushed into overtime. So it can only be like for like, and therefore if it's $30 an hour, it can't all of a sudden be $50 an hour if that shift gets swapped. Sickies is a different thing, but if they're swapping between themselves, and quite often those apps also have communication as well, where the people can put it up on a bulletin board and then people can bid for it.
Yeah.
But you can't bid if it's going to do that to you. So that's a really good one. And then because they're live, what your costs are right up to that minute of the week.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can make adjustments sort of moving forward. If you've got a lot of prep to do or not a lot of prep to do or something, you can actually put less or more people on based upon that. Other good ones out there are the ones that do ordering, where the ordering is actually holding, will not let you order certain products, will allocate to what supplier they go to because it's already locked in the system, and will also tell you where you're up to in that particular week as far as meeting your KPIs. So if you want to go out and spend another, you know, $1,000 on this special that's on this week, and it says, no, you can't do it.
Mm-hmm.
You can't do it. So that would be, you would have to make a special argument, you know, to your employer as to why you're going to break that protocol.
Uh-huh.
So it keeps people honest and then they can order less towards the end of the week to make sure that they're still staying at the right, their right gross profits.
Yeah,
so,
okay.
And then also these apps that control that will also ensure that your costing is correct. I mean, costing is something I see all the time. It's just, you know, ridiculous where people go, oh, yeah, this is our costs. And I go, can I just go into your system? And I go, well, on this one, you've got 50 grams as your portion of mashed potato. And on that one, you've got 200 grams. I've seen what you put on the plate.
Yeah.
And it's actually about 250 grams. So if I apply that to this one, your cost of goods here will go up by this much. And or when you see it, you see them free pouring salt and pepper squid, and you know their computer little program says 150 grams. And I said, well, actually, I just
free pouring salt and pepper handful. Squid. I like the sound of that.
and it was well, it's because it's all cut and it's all in, it's not pre portioned.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they're just grabbing handfuls of it, tossing it through the flour, throwing it in the fryer, and customers are getting anything from 150 to 350 grams. And I've definitely seen 350 sort of flying out the door. Well,
so is a more tightly organised workplace where there's much more accountability, numbers are known, portioning, tight labour controls. Is that a more attractive place to work? Does that attract more people or not?
It's a yes and a no, because the thing is, a lot of chefs like to work in a system where everything is organized, where food safety is good. So there's good food safety apps where everyone can be made responsible for cleaning this or measuring that temperature and automatically get told about fridges and all those sorts of things. At first, people will say to me, oh, this is onerous, this is going to take forever. But you can come back in a month and they're like, this is so good because the responsibility.
Yes.
It's now, we now have a shared responsibility.
And we finally got rid of Billy, who would never close up properly or would never do the temperature readings. And now we had a way that we could get rid of him.
Well, it's not so much about getting rid of them because it's, you know,
I just don't want to work
typical cleaning sheet.
Yeah.
Well, a typical cleaning sheet in most places is tick, 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 tick. The ticks are done in such a line, they might as well just draw a stroke through the whole thing because they tick them so quickly. And I go, well, who's checking this off? And they go, what do you mean? And I said, well, you've let Johnny tick all this and put their sign at the bottom. I said, but who checked to see if any of this was actually done?
Mm.
And they go, well, what do you mean? And I go, well, you as a supervisor should be going back and double checking at random, not every single item, to see if any of this actually got done or whether it was just tick and flick. And so once that happens, then staff become responsible. And believe it or not, the majority of chefs like to work in a place that has structure. Free for all sounds like fun, but you don't want to be the guy walking in the next morning when the fryer's got crap floating in it, when there's stuff jammed up in here, you open the microwave and there's still the splatter on the top of it.
And you find you run out of something and it wasn't on the list.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you know, but having proper lists that can be easily electronically ticked off on and people can see them on their phones. And so everybody's not doing the production and three people doing the same production because they're all reading off the same whiteboard and you know, no one's crossed it off or done anything correctly. And there's a lot less time wasting and a well-run kitchen using technology of all the different types is such a it's so much better.
Yeah.
And, you know, knowing how many of everything you sell. And you know, because you can go in and look at how much production people have got and say, well, you've got a lot of this out. And they go, we sell a lot. And I go, what's a lot? I said, I've got the numbers in front of me because, you know, this is what I do. This is my job. I'm a consultant. And I get given your numbers. And I said, you sell 15 in a week. I said, I just saw you prep 20. And this is like for one day. The stuff only has a three-day life. So what do you do? Wastage.
Yeah.
And then wastage becomes bigger than cost of goods.
So thinking about kind of wrapping this together, really there's no getting away from the fact that we're kind of down hundreds of thousands of potential applicants through lack of migration and people have left the industry and don't want to come back into it. But the place that is going to be a magnet for the people who are still around is, picking up on the last part we've been talking about, you're going to be, you know, to work tightly organised, well organised, equipment works, there's a sense of fairness too about, you know, the way we operate. I get a sense that there's a mix of ages as well.
Yeah, definitely, yeah. And training, you know.
Yeah, and opportunities for everyone to get better at doing whatever it might be that is on their ambition. And their mum force may not want to become chefs, but who knows, someone might actually want to do a Certificate 3 or 4 or something like that at some stage.
And school, I mean, and your work experience people that come in and work for you or your young people, they might not want to be chefs either. So they might just want to finish their apprenticeship and leave the industry.
In the next 4 years, which will be pretty good too.
Yeah. Well, that's it. I mean, some of my best employees worked for me for 10 years while they were doing a double degree in law.
Yeah.
You know, and they were brilliant. So it's understanding what you're going to get from that person. Mm-hmm. And work with it. People need to be given the flexibility that they want. If they want to every second weekend off on a Saturday, then give it to them.
Yeah.
You know, there has to be that flexibility with that. And I'm hearing a lot more of that where people.
Yeah, and again, technology can make that much easier thing to organise too. Instead of the roster nightmare with the white out on the on the roster sheet and all that. So far behind now. Great to talk to you. What would you, sort of someone who's listening to this and wants to just kind of dive into in the next few days, make a few very quick changes, what would you suggest that they start on first?
Make sure everything's working.
introduce
as much technology as you can to control as much. Because if you can't verify all the activities that are supposed to be there, from food safety to costs and all these things, and if you can't give a definitive answer straight away on all of those things, then you need to pick them off one by one. What is your training matrix? What is your food safety matrix? Is it real? Is it imagined? You know, what is your cost control? Is it real? Is it imagined? I've seen your end result. It's imagined.
Yeah.
So make it real. So
I've got an article in my newsletter this week, which says if you're doing a staff survey, you could reduce it to one single question. And that question is, what is one thing that gets in your way from doing a good job? What's the one thing that's the most frustrating that we could fix? And I think that's what you're saying, really, isn't it? And in a few different ways, yeah.
And be positive. The industry will bounce back 100%.
Yeah.
It's been here for longer than anything.
Well, it'll come back from what we're probably only just kind of discovering what that is. But, yeah, it's coming back. It's just we don't quite know what the shape of it's going to be. But let's go along for the ride anyway, because people still want to eat out.
Absolutely. I'm excited to be part of it, you know, even after 40-plus years.
Yeah. Great talking to you, Paul. Really always enjoy our conversations. Where do people find you online? How do they make contact if they want to talk to you about consulting or just have a chat?
Yeah. chefpaulrifkin.com.au.
Beautiful.
As I say to people, Google me. You'll have a dozen links will pop up.
Yeah. Paul's also on LinkedIn, pretty regular on there too. So we'll put those links in the show notes. And great talking to you. Really enjoyed it.
Okay. Thanks very much, Ken.
Excellent. Thanks for joining me. I hope you're feeling inspired after listening to this episode. You'll find the show notes and links for today's episode on your podcast app and look for the link at the top of the hospo-reset.com website. Don't forget to subscribe to the weekly Hospo Reset newsletter and connect with Ken Bergen on LinkedIn and on Twitter.